Flying the Last Frontier. This is Aviator Cast, episode 91.
Calling all aviators, pilots, flight sim enthusiasts, and aviation lovers. You've landed at Aviator Cast. Join us weekly in our efforts to become better masters of the air through interviews, refreshers, lessons, training topics, simulator setup, hangar talk, news, and more. Buckle up and prepare yourself for this week's episode of Aviator Cast. Pre-flight complete, fuel on board, and flight plan filed. Let's kick the tires and light the fires. Here's your humble host, Chris Palmer.
Welcome, 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 aviators. You've landed at Aviator Cast. My name is Chris Palmer. Flying has taken me to many new horizons, adventures, and achievements. Some of the most gratifying type of flying is that of flying in Alaska, where I now live. While flying anywhere is wonderful, I'm just so happy to be flying in the last frontier, exploring this great land. No matter where you are flying, flying is an adventure and a journey with endless destinations, and there is so much to discover in this world still. So we all share in this great adventure together in aviation. This podcast is brought to you by Angle of Attack, a flight training media production studio, which I own and run. So if you haven't been to Aviator Cast before, first of all, a huge welcome. I'm happy to have you here. Aviator Cast is all about aviation passion. You can tell already that we're pretty excited about this stuff, and we love all things flying. We are also about inspiring aviators no matter where you are in your journey. So perhaps you're just getting started, or you're going to get started in several years, or you've always dreamed of flying and you aren't quite involved in it yet. You know, maybe you just started getting enough disposable income for it to make sense, or maybe you used to be flying, but now you're just enveloping yourself in the community to keep that flame alive. So that is what we're all about here, is keeping that flame alive, that passion alive. We do that by not only interviewing, inspiring people in the industry and people that are just simply pilots, but we also bring in different insights and different topics. One of those topics today we'll talk about. And overall, this is just a place for people from all different walks of life in aviation to come together to reignite the flame. I try to jump here and there in different areas in the industry and talk about what we can do to simply stay flying, fly with passion, fly with precision, fly with humility. I'm huge on the humility thing. So that's what Aviator Cast is all about. So at the beginning of every show, what I do is I read a few reviews, or at least one review, from iTunes or Stitcher or some of these other places where people can review the show. If you get your review read on the show, I'll actually send you a t-shirt, a very cool t-shirt, says Fly or Die on it with an F4U Corsair, very well designed, and I will send that to you no matter where you are, free of charge, as a thank you to the community for you simply being a part of the Aviator Cast community and leaving a review for the show. So just like last episode, I actually decided to do a couple reviews this time since I have a little bit of catch up to do. So I want to make sure I'm getting to you guys here. So I'm going to read the first one here. It says, wildly entertaining, deeply informative, 5 stars. This comes from Stitcher, and it comes from Fushman 007 from the USA. And he says this, I discovered Chris and Aviator Cast right back at episode 3 and can't wait for each episode ever since. I've gained an enormous amount of tips and knowledge from Chris and his guests through those learnings and inspiration. It fired up my motivation to go out and reach up for the sky. I had been a longtime desktop pilot, and by taking Chris's insight and ideas, took my sim flying to the next level as a type of ground school, which I believed helped me greatly in transitioning to the real deal and soloing in less than 10 hours. Congrats on that. That's awesome, by the way. Listening to the stories and tales from his quests leaves you inspired and wanting to go out and fly, learn, and discover. Whether new or experienced, there is a wealth of information and great references in each show. With Aviator Cast, you've found a wildly entertaining and informative podcast that you just don't want to miss. P.S. I really want to go to Alaska now. Keep it coming, Chris and team. So a huge thanks Fushman 007. I think maybe you give me too much credit, but congratulations on taking that passion you had for flight simulation and actually going out and getting a license. I think that's huge. Or at least you said you soloed in 10 hours. You're getting there. You're actually going and doing something. I think that is awesome. I definitely encourage that. Again, write me and I'll give you my email here in a few minutes after this other review. And I will send you a link where you can sign up for that t-shirt and I'll send one to you. All right, the second review titled Passion for Aviation, 5 stars on Stitcher, comes from B. Goldberg 19 from the USA. And B. Goldberg says, I recently found AviatorCast only a few weeks ago and managed to listen to all 90 plus episodes at work, in the car, wherever I feel the desire to fly and just can't. Flying is currently not accessible to me, but Chris has made it feel like I am in the cabin each time I listen to the show. I love the blend of flight simming, which I spend more time doing than actual flying, as currently it's not something I can afford. AviatorCast has done an incredible job keeping me plugged in and allowing me to continue to grow my passion for all things aviation. You can feel Chris's passion for aviation, and it is very inspiring. So, B. Goldberg, hey, I'm inspired by you too, man. Keep it up. I know that you're having a hard time right now not being able to afford the flying. I encourage you to keep reaching and keep finding ways to make that happen because it is absolutely, totally, and completely worth it. But I know you're doing all you can, and sometimes life just gets in the way and we have bigger priorities and we have to get off track for a while, but I hope you can get back on track. Okay, so you guys just left those reviews. I want to send you a Fly or Die t-shirt. Email me at aviatorcast.com. Very simple, me@aviatorcast.com, and I will make sure to send those off to you guys. All right, so on this episode, we are going to be talking about flying in Alaska this summer. So I have 6 major points that I want to focus on of things that I've been learning as I've been flying in Alaska this summer. Now, I've done more flying this summer than I ever have in Alaska while I've been here. While I've done some float training in the past and I've done some other isolated flying, I really haven't gotten into it like I have this summer. So while I haven't been flying every single day or racking up hundreds of hours or anything like that, I have been doing it enough to become more proficient, to think a lot more about what I'm doing in the area. And so that's what we're going to talk about today. Let's just dive right into it. So here it is, flying in Alaska this summer, 6 focus points. Okay, so when someone says flying in Alaska, for any pilot, that just makes them excited. In fact, if you guys remember back during my Oshkosh rehash of what I experienced there, I talked about going to a presentation by Ken Whittakin. And at that presentation, he talked about flying in Alaska. It was interesting. At the beginning of his presentation, he said, there's a room about 50 people. He said, how many of you have flown in Alaska before? And I was the only one that raised my hand. And he did too, of course. And then he said, how many of you want to fly in Alaska? And then the rest of everyone raised their hand. So I know that a lot of pilots, if they haven't flown in Alaska, they want to fly in Alaska. It's just one of those places that feels like it's still unexplored, still isn't tamed by roads, and just has a lot to explore. So I think a lot of pilots naturally want to fly in Alaska just because of that. So my major points are that I'm going to be talking about, just to give you a little bit of a preview, are 1, mountain winds and respect, 2, gliding and water survival, 3, off airport landing, 4, soft and short operations at airports, 5, traffic collision avoidance, and 6, flight plans always. So those are the 6 major focus points that I'm going to be talking about. I'm just going to go through them one by one and offer my candid thoughts about what I have experienced this summer and what I've been learning as I've been flying around and going to different places. So 1, mountain winds and respect. So what does it mean by mountain winds and respect? Well, as you know, here in Alaska, it is known for having steep mountains, actually one of the highest mountains in the world, Denali, and just overall some very rugged terrain. No matter where you are in Alaska, it's something to consider. While the western part of Alaska does get pretty flat and hilly in areas, a lot of Alaska, of course, are these towering snow-capped peaks that you see, or peaks that seem to rise from nowhere out of the water, which is very much like the town that I live in, which is in Homer, Alaska. So flying anywhere really in my area, and especially starting out, this being my home base, you have to think about mountain flying always. Now, it's also something where you just want to go explore. You say, I have friends in town. They want to go across the bay. They want to see something. They want to see some glaciers. And so you say, okay, to do that, how do I do that safely without putting myself in a precarious situation in the mountains? You know, 5 minutes out of town, flying out of town here, you're in the bush. I mean, you are almost immediately in an area that is remote, that is very difficult to get to. And that's going to be a common theme throughout my points here, is that it's just remote here and there are a lot of considerations to take into account. So when you think about mountains, one of the big things that you need to consider, and what a lot of pilots say, is that you need to visualize the mountains as like a like water rolling over rocks in a river. So you have to visualize the winds that way, in rolling over peaks, going down the other side, going through valleys. If you observe a small stream or a river, you can see the currents doing certain things to the rocks and the boulders in streams, rivers, water like that. So that is how you visualize, first and foremost, on an elemental level, what the mountains are doing. So it takes a lot of, I guess, creative thinking about what the mountains are actually doing. So apart from that, there are a lot of visual cues that you can use, or things you can at least do ahead of time to determine if it's going to be a rough ride for the day, if it's even worth going with people that maybe aren't experienced with flying, if it's going to be comfortable and nice. So it just depends, and you really have to look out for the signs. One of the first things I do is I look at the winds aloft. Well, first off, I look at the local winds here just on ground level. If the winds are really ripping here down at ground level, I know that there's a pretty good chance they're going to be ripping in the mountains 10 miles away. So that's my first sign. My second sign, if it's decent around here or it seems okay, is winds aloft. I look at the winds aloft in the area for 3, 6, 9,000 feet and see what they're doing. The mountains don't go above 9,000 feet around where I am. So that gives me a good indication of how fast the winds are at certain altitudes. If they're pretty high, I know that they're going to be working across those peaks, going up ridges, down the other side. Those are the sort of things that I'm really concerned about, is having my aircraft performance degraded in an area that would be difficult for me to escape. And so you have to visualize it that way to make sure that you always have enough aircraft performance or enough planning to get into or out of where you need to go or want to go. So I look at the winds aloft. Now, if I determine that all that's good to go, I'll actually go in the mountains, and I take things a little bit of at a time. You know, I don't commit myself to saying, okay, everybody, we're going to go up, we're going to look at this glacier, it's going to be beautiful. I say, we're going to go there and we're going to try it out, and if it's not good, we'll just turn right back out and get out of there. And you just take it a little at a time. And if you get bad signs of what's going on, maybe things aren't favorable to what you're wanting to do, then you tuck tail and run the other direction and get out of there. So a lot of what I do recently has been just taking friends and family up for pleasure flights. And I certainly don't want to put them in a situation where they feel uncomfortable. On the flip side of that, I typically almost always put them in a situation where there are very few bumps, it's comfortable, it's absolutely stunningly beautiful, and they just have fantastic experiences. So I'm really looking out for my passengers in that sense too. And there's a certain gap there. So there's the original smoothness, right? That I can fly in that is safe to fly in, that passengers like to fly in. And that's like the first third of where you could operate, okay? The middle third of where I would operate would be a place where I would be comfortable with certain bumps and certain things going on, but maybe passengers would be getting uncomfortable in that situation. So those are things that, you know, I would do, but wouldn't necessarily want passengers along for the ride to do. And then there's the last third, which would be things that are just kind of no-goes. Like, it, you know, this isn't looking good. It's not feeling good. I'm not sure the aircraft can perform. We're not going to do that sort of thing. Interestingly enough, once you get into these areas, there's more you can look for. So you don't just look at these invisible, you know, trusted charts sort of things with winds here on the ground at the airport and winds aloft. You want to look for the signs as you are in those areas. And so you can literally look at the leaves on the mountains and see what they're doing. See if any snow or dust is being blown off the peaks. Look for rotary clouds on the peaks. Look at what the water is doing on lakes. You can tell a lot about what the wind is doing just by what's happening on a lake. And, you know, you can see which direction the wind's blowing because it'll go over the trees, for example, on one end of the lake. There will be a gap or a calm water spot near those trees. And then for the rest of the lake, it'll be ripples or whatever. So you can tell the wind direction that way. And a lot of different signs like that. I think float pilots get really good at that sort of thing. I do look forward to learning more about that and certainly have a whole lot more to learn about flying in the mountains. But those are just some of the signs that I've been looking for. There are other interesting phenomena that happen here in Alaska where, you know, winds tend to come crashing down out of glaciers. And someone explained it to me as there's cold air right over the glacier and it's dense and it's descending. And then there's warm air too. So, you know, all that stuff mixing, you can get some really weird things happening in these valleys with glaciers. And glaciers are some of the most beautiful things to go see and fly over and flight see. So, you know, you have to, in order to see that stuff, you need to know the kind of conditions you're dealing with. And I, again, always get in a situation where I tell my passengers, we're going to go over there. We're going to check it out. If it's not good enough, we'll just come back out. And I typically say that on days where I know it's probably a little bumpy and we're just going to have to see what it's doing at that time. You know, you can have wind change just 10 or 20 degrees in a certain direction and it will completely change the feasibility of going into a certain canyon or doing a certain thing based on how the wind would be reacting with the terrain. So those are just some of the things that need to be considered when thinking about flying in the mountains. Now, this is a huge topic. You could go on and on and on. There are books written about this stuff. In fact, I bought a book this summer in Anchorage to learn more about it. So I'm not professing to really know a ton about it. I'm just getting started. And these are some of the things that I've been experiencing so far. And it's been some of the most beautiful flying I've ever done in my life, but it demands respect. So that's number one, mountain winds and respect. Number two, gliding and water survival. Now, where I live is I live right on the coast. So when thinking about water survival, I think a whole lot about my ability in a single engine airplane to glide back to something that is hard, something that I can land on or at least be near to if my single engine, my one engine was to fail. And while that is a very improbable thing that would happen, it's something that I certainly think about a whole lot because there is just a lot of water where I live. Look up Homer, Alaska online. You will see that we are surrounded by water here. We're in a bay and just a lot of things could happen if you're not careful. And not only that, in areas that I've flown across the Cook Inlet, which you can also look up on Google, you will see that there's even a larger gap there. So flying over water isn't necessarily or doesn't necessarily need to be a dangerous thing. And so what comes into play here is glide ratio. You have to think to yourself, what would happen or how long would it take for me to glide to a shoreline if I was to lose my engine over this water? And so that really depends on each airplane. You can get these figures for your airplane in the operating handbook, but it is so much more than that. You need to determine where you are going to cross the water, how long that is, and you also need to determine how high you're going to need to be in order to glide either way. One consideration you can use is a midway point. You don't necessarily need to be able to glide from one end of that water to the other end. In my opinion, you need to have basically a point of no return. So it's not necessarily a midpoint because it would be wind dependent, but consider that at the midpoint of that crossing, you would be choosing to go to either side. So once you cross the midpoint, you're going to be going to the near side, which is ahead of you, right? And that's where you would be gliding to, assuming that the winds were in your favor for the glide. So I've been thinking about that a lot because I've gone to some of these areas where I've needed to glide. There are a good number of pilots and operators around here that will fly out of, or at least below, gliding range in their airplanes, but they have much better equipment than I do. And, you know, I can't necessarily afford to go out and get a raft right now. And part of me asks, can I really afford not to get a raft, even though I've calculated the glide ratio and all those things? Those are some of the things I think about. But you got to weigh all of these things when you're talking about crossing bodies of water. I remember at one time I was flying in the Midwest, and the pilot or person I was flying with, not a pilot actually, wanted to fly across Lake Michigan, I believe it was. And is that the one? I'm not sure if that's the one near Chicago, but so they wanted to fly across the lake, and that is Lake Michigan. So they wanted to fly across the lake and basically shortcut from, we were flying from North Dakota to Grand Rapids, Michigan, and they wanted to just cross the lake in a single engine airplane. And I said I wouldn't do it because I didn't want to get, you know, drop into that cold water. Now, at that time, I knew a lot less about the water and gliding distance and that sort of thing. And I wasn't really considering as much because here you have all this land surrounding like one huge body of water that you'd have to consider glide in. And then now I'm in Alaska where I'm having to consider it basically all the time. So it's basically reversed. So gliding in water survival is something I've thought about a whole lot. I purchased some life vests. They are life vests that are, they're basically a CO2 charge. It's manual. You don't want an automatic one because if you land in the water and you get knocked out and your vest automatically inflates, then it could actually trap you in the airplane. It would be very difficult to get out of the airplane. You know, say that you were submerged and locked all the way in the back window, and you had to swim out through the door. It'd be very hard to swim down. If you've ever tried to swim down with a life jacket on, it'd be almost impossible. So you just kind of want to build those things in your favor. So lots of considerations. I still have so much to learn, but I've been learning a whole lot about gliding distance with the airplane that I'm flying. I'm flying a 172, and there have even been instances where I've tested it out to see what is this like, how does it operate, how does it work. I've been doing some commercial training where I do power off 180s so I can kind of see how that works. Now, I would like to go out and do some testing longer distances and see what the actual numbers are, not necessarily by the book, but by this airplane. What are the numbers? How far can I glide per mile? You know, how much altitude do I lose per mile of glide? And then that will give me a little equation that you can do pretty simply for how much altitude do I need to cross X miles of water. So those are the things to consider. And those are things that I've been learning about water and gliding in Alaska this summer. So that's number two. Number three, off airport landing. And I would call this more of emergency landings. So flying around here and, you know, kind of piggybacking off of gliding and water survival is, where would I land if I were to have an engine failure right now? You know, this area is not like, the Midwest. It's not like these large metropolis places in the lower 48 where there are basically roads everywhere, pastures, pretty favorable places to land. It is still very, very remote here, even in the areas that are quote unquote populated. And so where I am, there's actually only one road that goes from where I am down to the end of the road, which is actually my town. It's a 4-hour drive. It is literally only one highway that goes down there. It's the same story between Anchorage and Fairbanks. There are a couple different ways to get there and more roads from there, but there aren't really any roads going to the west. I mean, in other words, this area is just, it is not very populated at all. So you don't have a lot of favorable places to land. You know, a lot of the time I'm imagining the improbable. I'm imagining, what would it be like if my engine failed right now? What spot around me would I choose? Would I choose trees? Would I choose water? Would I choose that beach down there? Would I choose a sandbar on the river? What about the tundra? What about a swamp? What about a road? All of these areas have challenges. Trees speak for themselves. They're big, they're sharp. You could hit the top. You could impale sticks and stuff into the windows. Water, you have a lot of things to fight against for landing anyway. While water is flat, I'm not the best swimmer. I know how to swim, but I know I'm not a strong swimmer. And I know that especially in the cold water around here, I wouldn't be able to swim very far, even if I had a life jacket. I'd only be able to swim several hundred yards, you know, maybe a little bit further than that. But that's about the limit I'm putting on myself, just because I know that would be such an intense situation. So what I really want to be fighting against, the whole drowning thing, if I were to have an issue, beaches are a pretty good option. And I think a lot about how beaches are a good place to land. Of course, you have to be cautious about the soft, sandy areas up near the top of the beach, but down near the tide part of the beach where the water comes in and out based on the tides, that area can actually get pretty hard and can be a decent place to land. In fact, a lot of airplanes land in those locations anyway. It's a pretty good off-airport location to land. And of course, because there's a lot of water around here, there are a lot of beaches as well. Sandbars work pretty well. There are a lot of rivers around here with sandbars. You got to be careful there because you don't know how large the rocks are, especially if it's a if it's an area where you're unfamiliar with. You don't know if it's soft sand, actual sand. You don't know if it's rocks. You don't know if they're larger rocks. You don't know if they're almost boulders. It's very hard to see from a couple thousand feet. So you just got to be very careful with that one. Tundra, probably not a great place to land, but it is fairly flat. Not a lot of trees generally. And that one is possible. There are some pretty good stuff, even some pretty good mountain ridges that are technically tundra, but generally flat. And there's some possibilities there. Roads, then you're dealing with power lines. You're dealing with cars. So there are a lot of challenges here because, A, there aren't a lot of roads to begin with. Even if there are, you've got to have all the normal stuff that's wrong with roads. And then 99.9% of everywhere else, you've got these very wild challenges and things that are just typically dangerous for landing locations. That said, there's also a lot of nice natural places to land around here. I'm excited later on in my flying here in Alaska to get into some of that off-airport landing. But the emergency stuff has just opened my mind and I've thought a lot about it. One thing I know I can work on a whole lot is taking survival equipment with me every time and almost adding it, well, literally adding it to my weight and balance as a required item that, you know, I'm going to be taking a sleeping bag and a stove and certain things with me every time. It's going to take up 25 pounds of storage in the airplane, but I will have some survival equipment just in case I have to put down somewhere. That's something that I need to do and something that I need to work on. I've done it on certain flights, but I need to make it something that's just what I do. So while it's very beautiful and vast and diverse around this area and just incredible places to explore, these places are also very rare and humans don't typically go to a lot of these places. It is very wild, untouched, and I just have to be very careful about where I fly. So that is number three, off airport landings. So number four, not quite off airport landings, but a different type of landing and takeoff, is short and soft operations. So these would be shorter airfields where there was potentially soft gravel, grass, mud, dirt that I could potentially get in. So Alaska is a little bit different. A lot of the airports down in the lower 48, big concrete runways, you know, 4,000 to 6,000 feet long at the smallest airports. Gravel, or not necessarily gravel, but asphalt. Just really nice airports 80% of the time. Let's use the 80-20 rule. So 80% of the time, you're getting pretty decent airports with a paved runway, and they are all over the place. Now, Alaska's switched. So in Alaska, 80% of the quote-unquote airports are off airport, meaning they aren't an airport at all. And then 20% are the nice airports, where you'd get a nice runway. So even of those 20% of designated airports, if you will, many of them are gravel strips. So that is something that is new to me in operating most of the time on a gravel strip. The airport I'm at here in town, in Homer, is still quite a long asphalt, very nice commercial airport. So it's 6,500 feet long. We get airline service in here with Dash 8s and Beech 1900s. We have the Coast Guard practicing in here with their C-130. C-17s land here every now and again. So it's a big, big runway that larger airplanes can use, which I think is pretty typical of what most people experience when they go out and do flight training in the lower 48, is they're learning at a place that's a big, nice asphalt runway. It's typically in a town or a city where the population is large enough to support something like a flight school. And so that's where most people learn to fly, is on a big asphalt runway. Now, again, that 20% of airports here in Alaska that are improved airports, many of those are gravel and shorter as well. So one thing I've been doing a lot more is I've been working to make my skills proficient on shorter runways that are 2,500 feet long and gravel, or 2,000 feet long and gravel, or some of them are 3,000 feet long and gravel. Now, the Cessna 172 can take off in about roughly 1,000 feet. Some airplanes can take off even shorter than that. 1,000 feet, even for a Cessna 172, is actually pretty long. If you do some soft and short field control techniques, then you can certainly get off much sooner than 1,000 feet. You can even get off in 300 feet, as my instructor actually taught me or showed me several weeks ago. But this is just a new thing for me. So working at these airports. Now, because my home airport is still a long runway, there's one specific thing that I've been working on, and that is don't become lazy and complacent with this really long, big runway like I had in the past when I was learning to fly, when I was doing my private pilot, when I was flying all over the Western states. You know, I kind of became lazy because I wasn't operating in short airfields really at all. I was always dealing with something that was much longer, you know, only using up at most a third of the runway and just easy places to fly into. Whereas now, you need to be on your game. You need to hit your spot. You need to, you know, use that soft and short field technique on the controls to make sure that you're doing what you need to. So on the big runway, one thing I've been practicing is hitting the number. So We have runway 4 and runway 22 here in Homer. So I will hit the runway number as best as I possibly can because that's a pretty good spot to hit. Now, interestingly enough, coming the opposite direction, I've been using a bit of a different technique. If I'm landing runway 22, I actually typically like to use a different marker on that runway because the taxiways are so far down the runway. I don't want to land on the number on one side of the runway and then taxi for a mile to the other side of the runway. So I've been a little bit careful about that, to rather choose a different marker on the runway to hit rather than land at the beginning of the runway. But if it's runway 4, I'll try to hit the number every time. So I'm practicing that short field, soft field technique. Now, another thing about that is a lot of the soft short fields around here, they aren't just soft and short or gravel, and gravel isn't necessarily soft. It's actually a pretty nice hard surface to land on, but you still have to practice caution with kicking up rocks and that sort of thing and digging in your nose well. You just got to be careful with that. So you still do have to be careful, but here in Alaska, you're not necessarily just dealing with the length of the runway or the softness of the runway, the firmness of the runway. You are dealing with a lot of the terrain around. So you're not only dealing with, again, the length, but you're dealing with trees, you're dealing with mountains, you're dealing with a different approach path, you're sometimes dealing with water. And so there are a lot of things to take into consideration there. One thing I joke about with some people I talk to about flying here and learning to fly here and getting more proficient in flying around this area is, most of what I'm doing and learning is simply how to fly closer to trees and be comfortable. So that's really kind of a truism that's been happening, is you are flying closer to trees than you generally ever have in other flight areas. Now, of course, people that have grown up here and learned to fly here, it's not so much of a big thing, but you can't simply avoid trees. Of course, you always avoid hitting them, but you can't simply avoid trees by staying 1,000 feet above them all the time if you have to get down into a strip that's kind of surrounded on all sides by, 50-foot obstacles, trees. So it becomes interesting sometimes when you're going down through a little channel of trees. You have trees on both sides, and you're going down to a reasonable touchdown point on the runway. So that's another thing to keep in mind. Another thing that is big about this is learning what your airplane is capable of. And again, that goes back to maybe being a little bit too lazy about aircraft performance when you've got a nice big runway. Typically how I like to take off, if it's a nice big runway and I have passengers and it's just a nice kind of comfortable situation, is I put the throttle forward, I go through my engine checks as I'm doing that airspeed check, and I just let the airplane kind of fly off the runway when it's ready, right? And while that is a good thing to do, there's also something to be said in these other situations where you have to get off the runway, where you need to be coaxing the airplane a bit more to get off sooner. And that is what short takeoff and landing is all about, is making sure that you are getting the most out of your particular airplane. Now, that not only comes down to what your airplane is capable of as a base model airplane, but it also comes down to learning the particular personality of your airplane. So I fly a couple 172s right now. One of them is older. It's a 1969 model. And then I fly another one that's a 1975 model. And they both operate very differently. While the numbers are in most cases just a few knots away from each other, if not exactly the same, they operate and perform very different, to the point where it's noticeable. One has vortex generators and some other things and a higher powered engine and a different propeller and a power flow exhaust and some things that makes it a better airplane, but they are still things that I have to keep in mind. So those are all considerations. While you may be flying a 172 or whatever it is, you need to learn the particular personality of your airplane that you're going to be flying. And one thing that I've been doing is I've simply been going out and practicing this sort of thing. So I will go to an actual gravel strip by myself and I'll practice and I'll get it right. And if it's not looking good, I'll go around. I did a Periscope several weeks ago. Periscope is a live streaming thing where I live streamed some takeoffs and landings at a gravel strip just north of where I am. And it was great practice. And after that, several days later, I took passengers across a body of water, taking into account what we talked about gliding and water survival and that sort of thing. So we did all that. We did it very safely, had a great flight plan, and went to a gravel strip and landed there. And having already practiced that a little bit and become familiar with it again, I was more comfortable. And while that may sound silly to a lot of pilots, especially pilots here in Alaska that do this every day, you know, it's something that, as any pilot does, there are skills that you don't use all the time that sometimes you need to refresh up on. So that is certainly something that I've been doing with short and soft operations, short takeoff and landings at the typical airstrips here in Alaska. So that has been a lot of fun this summer. You know, typically those places with those airstrips are very great places to visit. So it's been a lot of fun. So that's number four, short and soft operations or short takeoff and landing operations. Number five, traffic collision and avoidance. So we have a lot of whiz-bang features these days. Several months back at Sun and Fun, I bought a Stratus 2S. Now, a Stratus 2S is this GPS ADS-B unit that you suction cup to a window in your airplane. It connects to the iPad and ForeFlight and some different electronic flight bags as well. But it's this tracking unit that gives you a lot of data for a very affordable price. So typically it's actually free data once you buy this unit. You're getting ADS-B data, which is essentially traffic and weather for free on this government service that's been built out in the United States. Now, I bought that in the lower 48. I bought it in Florida. That's where Sun and Fun is. Brought it up here, and there's just not a lot of ADS-B data around. Well, there is an ADS-B mandate that says that all airplanes need to be equipped with it by 2020. There just aren't a lot of people around here complying yet. And so the areas that, if you fly in the congested areas around here, that being Anchorage and some of the flight paths along kind of a vertical corridor from where I live all the way up to Fairbanks, you experience a lot of traffic in particular areas. And in those areas, not a lot of that traffic has ADS-B. But there's a ton of it. There are a lot of small airplanes. They're almost all flying low, and you really have to keep your head on a swivel. So I have been flying a whole lot, although I am an instrument-rated pilot. I've been flying a whole lot simply just looking outside the airplane, not only because it's fun to look out and see the beautiful scenery, but also because I know that there is traffic a lot in Alaska. A lot of the guys don't talk on the radio. It's hard to spot some of these people at times. And so I've just been extra careful and vigilant about looking for that traffic. And I feel like I'm building that skill up again. Whereas on the opposite side of things, there are all these technological features these days in getting a Stratus 2S or a G1000 or a GPS with all of these traffic collision and avoidance mechanisms that allow you to see traffic. And while I fully support having that as a situational awareness thing, what happens when you don't have that anymore? That is typically what's been happening to me. And so I've been looking outside the airplane a whole lot more, looking for that traffic and searching for it. You know, I was flying across the bay here in Homer, just kind of loitering over a glacier, taking pictures and things with friends. And out of nowhere, a couple hundred yards away, here comes this red airplane, a red float plane right by me, couple hundred yards away. And he wasn't making radio calls at all, which is just what it is. I mean, I was on the right frequency, the common traffic frequency for the area. They weren't making radio calls. You just have to keep your head on a swivel around here and do what you can. And of course, communicating yourself is a big part of that. Participating in those common traffic advisory frequencies, those CTAFs, is a big thing. You know, participate and then everyone else can benefit from that. So that's kind of what I've been experiencing recently. I've just been looking out for those areas where I know that people are going to be going on tours or where the airports are getting busier. And so while you don't have to scan the entire sky with the same intensity, meaning you can visualize where people's flight paths are going to be, say in the pattern or through specific canyons or over specific reporting points, you know, you keep a good general scan, but then you can focus on some other areas. That's just all things that I've been relearning a little bit here and learning specifically for this area. So that's been really great as well, is that traffic collision and avoidance. So that's number five. Number six, flight plan always. So a really interesting thing about the whole ADS-B conversation and just the vastness of Alaska is that this area does not have widespread, almost 100% radar coverage like you see in the lower 48. We have wild areas around here where there's just really nothing around and you can't necessarily rely on your radar because you may be flying low and slow going to a scenic area or an off airport landing or something where you're not going to be in good communication. So what I've learned is that even flying 5 minutes out of town, you are already, again, in the bush. You're in the wild. You're in places where people rarely ever get to see or go. And so even on the smallest of flights, it's really important to file a flight plan. And so that's one thing that I've been actively working to do is just making a habit of I'm going to file a flight plan. I know I'm only going to be out for an hour. I know I'm only going to be within a 15 nautical mile radius, 30 nautical mile radius of my home airport, but I am going to do this anyway. You know, I'm going to file the flight plan so they know where I am just in case I don't come back because this area is so remote. So it just takes a few simple steps. And one really great thing is that we have a flight service station right here at the airport. So you can actually request that flight plan from them. And I actually also learned that there's something called a master flight plan. I'm not sure if this is something that is offered outside of Alaska, but there's a master flight plan you can file where they already have all your information on file. You tell them your tail number, and then you have like only two or three of the data points that you need to tell them, you know, how much fuel you have, how many people on board, how long you'll be, that sort of thing. And then they have everything else. So it's kind of like an abbreviated flight plan you can give them on the radio right before you take off. And it's very helpful. So I've been working on that as well. And of course, with something like ForeFlight is very useful too, because you can file a flight plan just super easy from ForeFlight. And what I've learned that's beneficial about using something like ForeFlight is you'll have specific flight paths that you go around here that aren't on an airway or they aren't in a typical area. And so you can actually put lat-long waypoints in there just by moving waypoints around on the map in ForeFlight. And then you can actually send in your flight plan with those lat-long waypoints. And so if search and rescue was ever to come and find you, if you had an issue, they would have a smaller area to search, in other words, and know what your intended flight path was, maybe through terrain or whatever it is. And that's really helpful as well. Of course, things like that, the Lockheed Flight Service will actually send you updates for your particular flight plan with NOTAMs and different things that are happening. They'll push those to your phone, and so you can get those when you're en route if you have cell service, but you can certainly get them before you take off So that's really helpful as well. And it's just a few clicks of, you know, a few clicks of your phone, a few taps here and there, and then you file the flight plan and you're good to go. You call up on the radio, you activate your flight plan, and that's all good to go. But I've just found that filing a flight plan around here, which I have found is a rare practice in the lower 48, is something that you just do all the time. It's something that's a great habit to keep. And it ensures that if something were to happen and you did have to make one of those unlikely, improbable, as I said, off airport landings, that flight service would know where to find you, because this is a wild place and you don't want to be without help for very long. So that was that's just something that I've really been working on as well. So just a quick review. We've got the number one, mountain winds and respect, just, you know, getting to know the mountains and what they have to offer. You know, it's very beautiful, but it demands the respect. And it takes learning and experience to fly in the mountains. Number two, gliding and water survival, learning the glide ratio of your airplane, and also making sure you have survival equipment, that sort of thing, and making water crossings with the ability to glide to either side. Number three, off airport landings or emergency landings. Say that you needed to put down an emergency. What type of terrain are you going to land on? Again, going back to survival equipment, I mentioned that's something I could be better at. Number four, the short and soft field operations or short takeoffs and landings. That's a big thing. I think I'll be learning about that the remainder of my flying career, be honing those skills. Number five, traffic collision and avoidance. That one kind of speaks for itself. Just learning around here how to scan better, since not everyone is participating in the ADS-B program because it still is a very kind of wild, unregulated area where a lot of people are flying around low and slow with you. And number six, flight plans always. So those are the six things, some of the things that I've been learning flying this summer in Alaska. I hope that you guys, no matter where you live, even if you don't live in the United States, that you're able to take a couple of these tips, think about them, and use them in your own flying. Because I think that no matter where we live, as a community, as an industry, we all have something to learn from each other, no matter where that type of aviation is taking place. You know, aviation, like math, I believe, is a universal language, and we have things to learn from each other no matter where we are in the world. So no matter where you are in the world, I hope that you have learned something from these six focus points of me flying in Alaska this summer that you can take for where you live. So that's it. We're going to have a couple closing remarks here, and then we will bid you adieu until another AviatorCast episode. So stick with me for a couple seconds, and I'll close out here at the end, just like I would with a good flight plan.
Join us next week for another exciting topic or interview with a great guest. Spread the AviatorCast message. Please review AviatorCast on iTunes or submit an audio question for the show at aviatorcast.com. All iTunes reviews and audio questions that are aired on the show will get an official AviatorCast t-shirt. You can write AviatorCast directly on aviatorcast.com, where you can interact with the AviatorCast community, or write AviatorCast at me@aviatorcast.com. We'd love to hear from you. For more information on angle of attack simulation training videos for FSX, X-Plane, and more, go to www.flyaoamedia.com. If you are looking for professional aviation training video services and other media, inquire at www.angleofattackpro.com. Now, for the final release clearance, back to Chris Palmer.
Guys, it's always great to get with you and share with you some of the things that I've been experiencing, whether that be an interview or something like this that's a little bit more personal, I guess, things that I've been going through. I hope that you've learned something today. Again, I really appreciate you guys being here. If you ever have anything to ask me or you want to reach out, you can do that through me@aviatorcast.com. A very simple email, me@aviatorcast.com. That will get you in direct contact with me. You know, one thing I want to point out to you guys is I've actually been really active on Instagram lately. And the Instagram username is Angle of Attack. I've been posting a lot of great photos, some videos of me flying around Alaska this summer, doing things around Alaska this summer. And of course, when I go and travel to different locations, I'll have things there as well that I share with you guys. So it's pretty active. I think people are liking it. It's growing week after week. So if you want to engage there as well, feel free to do that. I'd be happy to have you guys. I'm always happy to have you here. And I thank you for being part of this small AviatorCast community. You guys are absolute rock stars. Of course, I always have to thank the crew here at Angle of Attack. These guys do awesome work behind the scenes that pay for the equipment and allow me to step away from the normal day-to-day business to do things like this. So I really appreciate all that they do. Join us on the next episode. I'm going to have another topic for you guys. I also have some interviews that I want to bring in here. I think I'm also going to bring in Richard Graham again, the SR-71 pilot we had in the last episode. And we're gonna sit down and talk to him a bit more about his flying experience. I think that'd be fun. But we have some other people we wanna bring on board, and I'm working to do that. And also in the meantime, I've been flying a whole lot and just having a lot of fun here at the end of the summer, just trying to soak in the sunshine, if you will, and enjoy the good weather while we have it here in Alaska, because it's going to get pretty murky soon with the winter coming up. So apart from that, I really appreciate all that you guys are doing. Again, feel free to reach out to me if you want to. Don't forget to leave a review for AviatorCast, because it really does qualify you pretty well to get one of those fly or die t-shirts. And go out there and get it, guys. If you have a dream to fly, or you haven't flown in a while, I really encourage you to take the steps to make it happen. There's just something that flying does for the soul that nothing else can do. I don't know what it is. It's just this different perspective, almost this spiritual connection that's just so awesome. So if there's anything I can do to support you, again, let me know. But that is it for this episode of AviatorCast. Again, thanks so much, guys. Until next time, throttle on.
Yeah, 5-8 is ready. 5-8 is the short line, turn left, heading 235. Maintain 2000, runway 25 right. Clear for takeoff.
Clear for takeoff, 25 right, United 580.